Hello, and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal, Dr. Craig Dale, and this week I am joined by a special guest, Bill Austin. Hello, Bill. Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself?
Hi, Craig. Good to see you. I was a career customs officer with Customs and Excise for about 30 years, and then the subsequent 10 years was as a consultant across Africa, across Eastern Europe, putting in customs systems into post-conflict countries.
So, as listeners might have guessed from that, the topic of the podcast this week will be borders and customs. Very important topic, one we get asked about all the time. Bill co-authored a paper for Commonweal a couple of years ago now on the principles for borders and customs in an independent Scotland. It's also one of the topics that has been very important and well discussed around Brexit. Not always in positive terms. So let's start with Brexit and a general appraisal from yourself, Bill, on how the UK has handled the border argument that it has faced.
In one word, London bluffs. When it comes to Brexit, the situation currently in terms of customs at the border is a complete misnomer. To think of how to bring African and European new customs officers onto the subject of how to run a customs service, UK currently is an excellent example of how not to do it. The big picture, the governance, if we start with the fact that HM Customs and Excise, as was, belonged to the Treasury. And if you look as a worldwide standard, the Customs Service, generally speaking, is part of the Treasury system, the Exchequer system, call it what you want. Why? Because it's to do with collection of revenues. It's to do with protecting national revenues. So currently, the UK gives its customs, inverted commas, controls over to the Home Office. In effect, it's a policing action.
Yeah.
Customs is very, very much minimal in the day-to-day responsibilities of a border force guy. Border force are not customs.
Yeah, this was one of the strange things I found when you introduced me to this topic, that the UK has focused almost entirely on immigration and the movement of people to the exclusion of the movement of goods, to the point where, as you alluded, the old Customs and Excise Office has been disbanded, split up. You now have Border Force and you now have HMRC, the Revenue and Customs, but as you're saying, it doesn't do much of the C part.
Well, exactly. The HMRC, it does become confusing, even to the officers who are trying to carry out day-to-day controls. HM Revenue Customs are inland. They do things like VAT and excise revenues. What's excise? That's the revenues collected on fuels, and we're talking about for vehicles, for aircraft, for ships, etc. They're inland, so how easy is it for them to ensure that checks and revenues on imported goods and vehicles, ships, etc., how can they do that from the city centre of Edinburgh when actually the ships and the aircraft are out at Turnhouse or sitting in a vessel in Grangemouth? There's a huge disconnect, and that's why it's an excellent example of poor governance.
Yeah, this was something I found, I think it was you that introduced me to this, when I was studying the contraction of HMRC in Scotland, with it closing down a lot of its regional offices and just moving everything to two large offices, one in Glasgow and one in Edinburgh. And one of the points that was made was, now if you want a specialist customs officer to interview someone who's been stopped at the border coming in at, say, Inverness Airport, rather than being based at Inverness Airport, they're now based in Edinburgh and they've got a 3-hour drive to get up there. It's not the most convenient way of running the show.
Well, there's a number of edges to that as well, because, for example, it, not only if you have a customs team in Ullapool, for example, they're local. People speak to them. They're picking up in local information, local intelligence, so that on the one hand, they better understand their patch,
yeah,
and where the revenues are generated, where the wealth is generated, because that's where the revenue comes from. How impossible is that if guys are sitting behind a laptop in Edinburgh when actually they're not even remotely going to understand what happens in Ullapool or Newton Stewart with the traffic that goes across from the north of Ireland? It's not good, to put it that way.
Yeah, and it would certainly put a new spin on if we tried to remake the film Whiskey Galore. I do remember a story. I think it's a couple of years old now, but it just highlights the fact that even pre-Brexit, the UK's customs was not fit for purpose. There was a story that there were a lot of goods coming into UK ports and then leaking into the rest of the single market without having the proper duties paid on them. And actually, the EU, I think, is still pursuing the UK for about 2 billion euros worth of revenue.
Well, that's absolutely right. At the point that London decided that borders were going to be handed across to the Home Office, the Home Secretary at the time was Theresa May, and she created an organisation called UK Border Agency, which was found to be not fit for purpose. After a few years, they put a red line through that. They created UK Border Force. So what? In direct answer to the point you made, the Chinese were bringing in shiploads, container loads of goods which attract anti-dumping duty. Without getting technical, basically the EU, it's in our collective interest not to allow people to have subsidised goods brought in. The point about this wee story is that the EU customs and services gave the UK boys chapter and verse, the names of the vessels that stuff are arriving on, the dates, the ships, and UK Border Force couldn't cope. The upshot of the story is that because the UK singularly failed to carry out their own responsibilities, they are responsible to the EU for the money that went missing. Therefore, Osborne had to hand across billions to Brussels,
yeah,
because the UK couldn't properly carry out its responsibilities.
And is this a problem that you think is going to get worse as Brexit progresses?
Well, the whole point about the poor governance is that when you and I walk through a Scottish airport, you'll still see signs up saying customs. That when something arrives from Amazon, for example, the tape on the box will say opened by customs. Mm-hmm. It's a smokescreen. There hasn't been a customs officer doing those jobs since 2005. So that smugglers, or not necessarily smugglers, let's call them corporations, are very creative in moving things from A to B. And unless somebody somewhere has a handle on what's taking place, then it's a free-for-all. Who does that benefit? Well, actually, big business, etc. It's not necessarily the smuggler. Who loses out? Us, society, the yeah, communities, who... When it's heartbreaking every time you hear someone saying we have to close down a community centre or we need money for this, that and the other. Well, actually, lads, there's a lot of money going awry because the UK government is singularly getting it wrong.
What kind of scale are we talking about here? Do you have an idea of how much revenue the UK is missing out on because it's not doing its own job?
Well, the example that I gave with the anti-dumping duty, that was measured in billions.
Yeah.
That was one example a few years ago. So in terms of earlier, we were chatting about the polar ice cap melting and that there's going to be an exponential rise in trade from Russia and China coming north to south. We could be the first port of call into Europe.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is massive ships, hundreds, thousands of containers on these vessels with potential revenue. If someone isn't looking at that, or put it another way, if we actually get our infrastructure geared up to facilitate that trade and it becomes the first point of the first port of call in the EU, then it's going to put Scotland in a sweet position.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that we talked about in Commonweal on our common home, our Green New Deal plan, is the long-term possibility of Scotland becoming a massive generator and exporter of hydrogen as a long-distance fuel, specifically for cargo ships. So, yeah, I can definitely see the possibility of Scotland becoming a stopover point if you're wanting to come over from the other side of the Atlantic and then go over the north, then stopping off in Scotland and refueling and paying duties and generating revenue while doing that is potentially extremely valuable.
Well, the way the EU try and structure themselves is to the customs is a small cog in a big wheel. That if you get your infrastructure, like the technical phrase is intermodal, where, for example, if Scotland had an all-singing, all-dancing port on the east of Scotland, where it was linked into road, air and rail, for example, then that's the sweet spot. The customs guy is there off to one side, ensuring that as to facilitate that trade for a start, to minimise friction, etc., etc., but to ensure that the revenue is protected. That's win-win. You know, why would we not do that?
Yeah.
But the key word is infrastructure strategy. And where does a self-governing Scotland want to stand with all of these movements and trade you're talking about, hydrocarbons, hydrogen fuels, etc., etc.? Have we, you know, big piece of blank A4, you know, have we thought about this and how can we maximise it?
Yeah, I mean, potentially you could see a port in Prestwick, for instance, linking into infrastructure there, taking cargo from, say, Ireland or from the Western Atlantic, going across land over Scotland, getting onto another ship in Rosyth and then going over to the Baltic, for instance.
And this is exactly what, you know, as I understand it, that's the way the France or Germany look at it.
Yeah.
You know, they try to see it big picture. To use the kind of technical customs cog in this big wheel, we talk about the single window, the French call it guichet unique. And the point is that if you have this all singing, all dancing port to airport structure, single window means that a company who wants to trade there, he knows that there's the banks are there, the environmental health people are there, the phytosanitary people are there, the customs guy is there, so they don't have to walk very far to be facilitated, and that's the name of the game. We want Scots exports and imports to be as frictionless as possible, and that's infrastructure.
Whereas the Boris Johnson plan seems to be just wall off sections, declare them free ports and ignore what goes on inside.
Well, it's just toe-curdling, quite frankly, because we've already demonstrated that there's a lot of revenue going wide.
Yeah.
Richard Murphy talks about tax gap. Well, in the, I think Richard has the tax gap currently annually about 90 billion. So what? Well, in that 90 billion mix is a lot of customs and excise revenues that are identified, that we know about, that's not collected. So why would we want to exacerbate that? I mean, that's insane.
Yeah, whenever I hear about that freeport idea, it just smacks to me of the UK saying we will eliminate tax evasion by eliminating taxes.
Yeah,
it's not evasion if the tax is already zero.
We could be cynical and say that what Boris actually wants to do is have a... you know, a 1950s Cuba off the coast of America where it's controlled by mafia, call them corporations if you like, where there is zero controls and they believe that they're going to trade with the EU. The EU are horrified by this.
Yeah, and quite rightly so.
Yeah.
It would undercut everything that they're trying to do in cracking down on exactly that.
Which is where the EU acquis comes into this, that as Edinburgh is thinking about how to best progress Scotland's future, whether it's EU or EFTA, the joining rules within EU ACQUIS, believe it or not, are not prescriptive. They are sort of broad brush, as in secure the revenues, ensure that hooky goods don't come into the EU system. But actually, you, Edinburgh, it's up to you how you do that.
Yeah, this is why the ACWI has a philosophy running through it of not just showing what you're going to do, but demonstrate that it can work.
Exactly.
So they're not too concerned about how you do it, as long as you can meet, you can check all the boxes and show that you can check them.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, again, using the point about the anti-dumping duty from China that was hitting the southern ports. That's a great example of how not to do it. So in terms of how Scotland would deal with that sort of thing, do you know what? You're not talking about permanent, hard border, aggressive friction. There are ways to be subtle about it. There's ways to finesse it. In fact, we could even call it smart borders.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. Let's look at, because this is the when people talk about borders in the independence movement, we all often do talk about looking at what's going on in Ireland and Northern Ireland on the border, and we start thinking about what's going to happen on the border between Scotland and England. Maybe it's good to start with just describing what we mean by a hard border and a soft border versus an infrastructure heavy border and an infrastructure light border, like a smart border.
Okay. From where I'm sitting, and this is an opinion of one, to talk about borders is actually a red herring. It's to miss the point. It plays into the unionist hard border argument, because automatically people think of the 100 miles between the Solway and the Tweed. That is utterly to miss the point. Because if you can imagine a map of Scotland and then go out 200 miles into the North Sea, do a 200 mile circumference around Scotland, then all of a sudden that border issue, in terms of hard border, to focus on that 100 miles between Scotland and England is to completely miss the point. The pub quiz question is, what is the, how many miles is the Scottish coastline? And the answer is something like 18,000 kilometres. It's longer than the coastline of metropolitan France. Mm-hmm. You can find the answer in the concise answer in marine.gov. The point being, if we're talking about borders and, you know, we have to stop that truck or ship, are we talking about, you know, the Mullican Tyre being border? Well, it is.
Yeah.
If we're playing the borders game. What I'm trying to put across here is that given our responsibilities, especially within the EU dimension, we're talking about a legal jurisdiction, and it changes the focus completely. Because let's say you're the new head banana of the Scottish Customs Service and you've got 1,000 people, Craig.
Yeah.
Where are you going to deploy them? Mm-hmm. Where is the revenue going to be generated? Where is the risk? Because you carry out a risk analysis and a risk assessment, then your risk analysis. And you've got to locate your resources to where you can secure the revenue. I respectfully suggest that the 100 miles on the border is to completely and utterly miss the point. I'd go further. If it helps people to understand what I'm trying to put across here is that our customs jurisdiction is massive. And you could, if it helps understanding that from the Tweed Solway area all the way up to Unst, the most northerly island in Shetland, those are the borderlands, if that helps understanding, because all of a sudden that when a ship or an aircraft or a vehicle comes off a ferry, whatever, that's where the jurisdiction starts. Let's not talk borders, because that plays into the unionist hands that basically we have to have dudes down at Gretna at a sentry box, we armed with a clipboard and a big hairy I'll get you and a chain. You know, that's to completely miss the point. It doesn't even remotely cover unprofessional from a customs point of view. It's also singularly ineffective within the 21st century. The whole border thing was set up when empires, you know, you needed a French tricolour on one side of an African country and a Union Jack on the other. The border was marked by a mountain chain or a river, you know, whatever you like. We're in the 21st century. You know, the jurisdiction, the customs jurisdiction I've just described is actually also three-dimensional, because you have smuggling through cyberspace, et cetera, all of a sudden, we need a hard border at Gretna. When, as soon as I hear Boris and his pals talk about that, is you have no idea what you're talking about, Chief. Absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
And I would go further that, for example, having worked recently in Djibouti and Ethiopia, Ethiopia is landlocked. The Djibouti and the Ethiopian Customs Services, and I'm using East Africa purposely, that they have got a really, really smooth, frictionless system where any amount of trade comes into a super switched-on East African port. They have rail systems, they have road systems. It goes into Ethiopia. Ethiopia is turning around as a country because of the amount of customs revenues that have been made. I'm trying not to laugh, but I've worked there.
Yeah.
So when Boris talks about hard border, when, you know, Carlo talks about hard border, the scary Project Fear 2 thing, they're having a laugh. They really are having a laugh.
That or they simply don't understand. They haven't seen how it works in any other normal country.
Well, exactly. And the curious thing from where I'm sitting is that for Scotland to be self-governing is actually very, very exciting from a customs point of view, because the World Customs Organization have something called the International Network of Customs Universities. We have another layer with the EU Customs Services. Scotland should be aiming to be one of the top five customs setups in the planet. There's a lot of stuff off the shelf. That there are no Scottish universities that are part of the international network of customs universities. So what? Well, it means that big bookshelf of how to run an effective custom regime, how not to do it, the UK has cut us off from that.
Yeah.
You know, it's insane. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, the potential is actually very, very exciting, and it's very, very positive.
Yeah, one of the things that I've kind of sort of I was down in the borders not that long ago, giving a talk on this topic. And yeah, there is still that concern that what happens if I want to go and visit my auntie in Carlisle? Well, I have to stop in a queue and show my passport, or I don't know if you want to talk about what would it actually look like to get in a car and go to England. But one of the things that kind of struck me is right now, the north of England and the borders of Scotland are, if they were in America, they'd be called the flyover states. The areas that you drive through to get to somewhere interesting, to use a very pejorative way of putting it.
Mm.
Go to Dumfries, it's lovely. But as soon as you then have a border there and you start having a bit of attention paid to it, whether that is infrastructure or whether it is just, you know, the policy implications of now having two independent countries with that are connected by land, suddenly both the north of England and the south of Scotland could see a bit more investment and a bit more attention, and, you know, rather than just being more or less ignored.
Well, again, the key word there is infrastructure, and what does Scotland as an infrastructure, as a national strategy, what is it we want to achieve? How do we facilitate that? Again, the customs guy is a small cog in that big wheel. In terms of the direct question about should mum, dad and the two kids notice that there's a border there, the answer is no, categorically, because, you know, it's the way they're trying to ensure that there's a frictionless border between the Republic and the north of Ireland is actually a fairly good example. Why would you want to stop people? Well, actually, if we look at the law and the way where we are at the moment, since Ireland became independent in the 1920s, there's been free movement for over 100 years. Why on earth would we change that?
In fact, there was a paper just released yesterday looking at Scotland's roadmap back into the EU, and it was quite clear that the EU has no patience for some of the opt-outs that the UK enjoyed before leaving, that Scotland's not going to get a formal opt-out on the euro, although I've talked before about the practicalities of actually joining. There's not going to be the same opt-outs in other areas. One area that would make sense to give Scotland at least a partial opt-out is on joining the Schengen area, the free movement area within the EU, for the same reason that Ireland has an effective opt-out on Schengen, that we are island nations and we already have a common travel arrangement between each other, and now with a country that is not in the EU, the remaining UK. So as long as that state of affairs is frictionless and open and kind of cordial, why change it?
Well, exactly. And it leads on to, you know, like we've got a car full of tourists, for example, coming from the continent. They drive up through England, they come into Scotland. How would you control that? Is there contraband? Are they illegal immigrants, etc.? Well, again, I would suggest that to think in terms of border being a hard line in the sand, the same principle applies to a 20-foot container on the back of an Arctic. It comes to the same thing. What I'm saying is that because that those two vehicles cross an arbitrary line in a map, mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily mean that they get a home run if they get to Glasgow. What I'm saying is that if we think to the jurisdiction aspect that I was trying to put across earlier on, that all well and good. Generally speaking, you know, like the amount of illegality, let's agree for the sake of argument a figure of 20%, which is well high, that the illegal immigrant, the contraband on the back of that truck doesn't stop being illegal because they've got a home run to Glasgow. There's no such thing. So anybody out there thinking, well, hold on a minute, does that not then mean that you don't need to have your controls at Gretna? Absolutely, got it in one. And it's the point about the poor governance of having our customs in two offices, in Edinburgh and Glasgow. If that hypothetical anecdotal vehicles get all the way up to Oban, then if there's customs guys who are switched on to illegality because the local community are saying, this isn't fair, that contraband is undercutting us, the local traders, they wouldn't be long in approaching the customs guy and say, do you know what, that truck there, you really want to have a look in the back of it? That's the way it works. Yeah. That's the dream scenario. Because, you know, what I'm also trying to suggest here is that every single citizen in Scotland becomes a customs officer, because when the revenue goes diffy, it means they are having to pay increased income tax, etc., for their hospitals, for the roads, yada, 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 because somebody else is cheating. We would collectively, as a community, have a collective interest in ensuring that revenues are protected within our own jurisdiction. And do you know what? It would make the EU very happy as well. Mm.
So rather than having just that hard line in the sand and you're across it, okay, you can do whatever you like, customs is then sort of permeates right the way through. So that truck of cargo, maybe it gets checked the next time it stops, or when it's offloading, or maybe even customs is just having an intelligence-led operation, and they kind of know, well, we've been tipped off that that truck's already in France, it's heading our way, when it gets here we'll stop it.
It's the name of the game. I mean, you could argue, cynics out there would correctly argue, well, that's the utopian scenario. Mm-hmm. Well, it is, but do you know what? If you have a front foot customs organisation who are switched on, they're professional, they're resourced, and they believe in the raison d'etre of protecting the revenue, then do you know what? You can generate outrageous amounts of revenue. I know this from hands-on experience across many places. The point I would make here is that somebody out there listening to this would say, well, how much is this going to cost? Well, do you know what? If we spend more than one penny to collect £1 of revenue, we have got it wrong.
That much.
And therefore, again, people would say, well, hold on a minute. You know, like, we've got people running after guys that are maybe window cleaners who are on ESA, and we're chasing them for screwing the system. Suppose we actually had switched on investigators looking at the corporations who are not paying millions, if not billions. Mm-hmm. Would logically that not be the smarter thing to do?
Yeah. This, again, is one of the opportunities I've seen time and time again when we've talked about plans such as how to start a new country, where Scotland becoming independent means setting up new institutions, and so many of these government operations are themselves revenue generating. The other example that we had was the central bank, which performs a whole slew of financial operations and ends up, it's not how much does it cost to set up, it's how much profit does it make and how quickly does it make back its initial outlay. If what you're saying with customs is very quickly.
Okay, so you know, this is the way ahead. And, you know, in terms of, as a consultant, and you go into any country in the planet, you start off with the big picture. You know, where is your wealth generated? Mm-hmm. You know, what is that GDP? Where do you get that from? So you have a kind of top-down approach. Let's call it quick wins, because they are. And if I said, for example, that the GERS figures, we know they're controversial, they know that maybe they're not accurate. If we could throw in some areas where is the wealth generated, therefore where could we generate revenues for our communities, then land and property comes into this sort of thing.
Yep.
Export energy taxes, you know, we're heading towards a green Scotland where we're going to be exporting energy, but we want to stick a couple of bob on the energy that we're exporting. Well,
That could especially be if we go down that hydrogen future and start servicing cargo ships, that sort of thing.
So this is the exciting part of it, that, you know, for the Scottish Government to sit down with a big whiteboard and do a bit of brainstorming, where is our wealth generated? Yeah. Because this is key to it. And it changes the dynamic of, we've got to have a hard border. No, we don't. Get a big whiteboard and say, where do we generate the wealth? Do we want revenues to be collected from that wealth? Should it be written into the constitution? Should we have simplified customs and tax laws where the citizen, the guy in the street, understands what's going on without having to have a Philadelphia degree, which, you know, the complexity of the current UK system is designed entirely to avoid, if not evade, revenues. There's a better way.
Yeah.
You know, and it starts with the big picture stuff.
Well, Bill, that has been absolutely fascinating. I hope folk out there have found it as interesting as I have. Just to finish up, as I always do with the podcast, just to say that Commonweal as an organisation, we are entirely funded by folk like yourselves giving us, on average, £10 a month. We couldn't do this without you. We're very grateful to the people who do support us, and we're very grateful to the people who listen to the podcast and read our policy papers and follow our work. If you're out there and you want to help us do even more, if you want to help us really show you a vision of what Scotland could be, from the big picture stuff down to the really detailed nitty-gritty, like how do we build a better customs agency, then I will leave a link to our donate page and you can sign up there. So thank you, and we'll see you later.
Thanks, Craig.